Good morning, diners and travelers. Welcome once again to the wonderful wild world of food, wine, and travel.
And the wonderful wide world of On the Menu Radio to boot.
Yes, with Ann and Peter Haig. I'm Ann.
See if you can guess, Peter. See if you can guess which is which.
Yes.
You can never tell these days.
We're going to be doing more or less a sweet program today.
A very sweet program.
Yeah.
With a touch of savory from his aunt at the end, but that's a secret. We'll keep that little secret up our sleeve. But we've got some really fantastic sweet people.
Oh yeah,
First of all, a couple of absolutely outstanding. What do we call it?
Pastry chefs.
You can't just call it. They're far more than pastry chefs.
Dessert wizards,
something like that. And one of them is a chocolate wizard. And then behind that, we've got more of the inside story of one of Anne's favorite ingredients, the wonderful vanilla. And a company that makes it in the United States. We're finding out new ways to use it all the time. And then we're going to finish up with something savory.
Yeah, the cheese lady.
So that's what's on the agenda for today. Now let's get off to a good start here with Johnny Iuzzini.
Iuzzini.
Well, I can't pronounce anything. Johnny Iuzzini. Did I get it right? It's from Benevento. In central southern Italy, which is famous in on the menu terms, because this is where Peter backed the car into the ditch. But fortunately for Italians, like Johnny came along and lifted us out. And I can't tell whether Johnny's tattoos are more magnificent than his desserts or vice versa. But certainly, if you look at the front cover of this book, he is a very handsome fellow with a beautifully developed and beautifully tattooed right arm. He says they're working on his left arm at the moment as well. But the book isn't really about tattoos. It's all about desserts, and desserts that come in fours.
Quartets.
They come in fours.
Yeah, quartets.
Quartets are made up of four. Quartets are made up of four things. You can never tell.
Yeah.
And this is a sort of a special way of doing dessert, Johnny, that came about how?
When I started at Jean Georges, the four-part dessert.
Yeah, let's mention that you were executive chef at Jean Georges.
Yeah, I'm the executive pastry chef at Jean Georges.
I mean, executive pastry chef at Jean Georges, and probably one of the best-known and respected pastry chefs in America.
Sweet, thank you.
Yeah.
Let's go back to foursomes.
Okay.
Foursomes. Threesomes. Okay, foursomes. The way I kind of inherited this system, actually. When I first started at Jean Georges,
There was
three, four plays on the menu, you know, and they were much, much simpler, and the pastry chef before me. So when Jean Georges opened, they started with that system. So when I got here from Danielle, I inherited it. So it was very different from what I was doing at Danielle. So it was an adjustment period at first, but then I got comfortable with it, and we added a fourth four play. So right now, if customers come in, you know, they have a choice between four different, you know, four plays. So it's potentially a table of four people could have 16 different desserts at one time.
Sounds like what a lot of chefs do to on the menu on purpose anyway.
Now, you have had a really illustrious career. I mean, you started out at age 15. You ended up at the CIA. You've been in all the top kitchens. I told you before we went on air that I was thinking how lucky this guy is. And then I realized, you know, that's probably not as how talented he is.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I go back and forth this all the time with people, and I am very, very fortunate. You know, I'm a kid that grew up in the Catskills, you know, between a cornfield and a sheep farm. And just by chance, I worked for the right people and made the right connections, and I got myself into, you know, some of the better restaurants at a very young age, and just, you know, put my time in and kept my head down and my mouth shut, and just learned from the best, you know, and eventually I worked my way up through the ranks and through these very, very, very famous restaurants and very famous chefs, and you know, worked my way up and eventually became a chef myself. Yeah, I can't thank these people enough for giving me these opportunities to work in their kitchens and for teaching me and training me. But I don't believe I was born a pastry chef. I believe I was born a kid with a desire to not be mediocre. And I think, you know, no matter what I did in my life, I would get to a certain level at, you know, because I refuse to be mediocre. That's always been my drive in my life to, you know, I was never great at schoolwork. I was always good with my hands, and I was creative, so. And I knew I couldn't be a lawyer or a doctor, so I had to find something that I can use my hands in that way. But I just couldn't be that guy that just, you know, just collected a paycheck every week. And I had to find something that I love to do and that I could push myself to be better at it every day.
Now, how did you find this way into a kitchen?
Well, you know, coming from an Italian family, you know, that we didn't have, there was no allowances, you know, there was no, here's some money, go have fun with your friends. No, there was none of that. There was more like, you know, you want to go do something with your friends, go get a job, you know. So I got a job, brought in my, I rode my 10 speed every day after school, starting at 15 years old when I got my working papers, to a local country club, and they hired me. I tried to get a job as a caddy and drive the golf carts around like my friends were doing, but I was the last one to, like, sign up, and I missed the chance, so I ended up as a dishwasher in the kitchen. And I stayed there. I liked it, and I washed kitchens, you know, I washed dishes, washed pots every day, and eventually the chefs would let me, like, peel carrots or use the deli slicer or, you know, little by little, when someone was missing, I'd help fill in here and there, so I started to learn my way around the kitchen a little bit. You know, but still, upstate New York, it was a lot of, like, packaged stuff and Cisco or whatever else. Like, not the fine dining that I'm in now, not the same arena at all.
I like your story about how you were at one restaurant and you got to deal with killing the lobsters.
Yeah.
But you couldn't cope with it. That's your mother was
my mom. So growing up upstate, we had a lot of land. And what my mother did, she was a vet technician, but she was by trade, she was a wildlife rehabilitator. So we grew up feeding all sorts of animals back to health. You know, we had raccoons, opossums, deers, vultures, anything that was hurt in the wilderness, like for five or six counties wide, would all come to my mother. And then my mother would either nurse them back to health and re-release them into the wild, or we would keep them for the duration of their lives because she wouldn't put anything to sleep.
So I grew up with
crazy pictures growing up with, like, a raccoon sleeping on my chest with little baby bottles, you know, feeding woodchucks with syringes, you know, to get them to eat and making them go to the bathroom. Like, I grew up like a huge animal lover, on top of the fact that we had every other kind of animals as pets, you know, ferrets, guinea pigs, dogs, cats, everything. It was a farm, you know, it was essentially a crazy farm.
So you didn't like pulling the claws off of lobsters, which sent you running for the pastry kitchen. I love that story.
So that's what happened. So the florist upstate here in New York, in the Catskills, was also the florist at the famed River Cafe at the time. And she's like, let me take you to meet the chef. And I was only 17. I had just graduated high school, and she brought me to meet the chef. And he's like, all right, you know, he hired me on the spot. And I started the next week, so I was in Garmager. But then, and this is when I start getting exposed to fine dining. You know, they would bring whole animals in for butchering. You'd see whole lamb or whole this or whole that, and all the lobsters would come in live, and I'd have to kill the lobsters every day. So this is when I was like, oh, God, I can't do this. I was like saying, like in the corner saying Hail Marys and stuff for the lobsters. I felt so bad killing an animal, you know, being raised the way I was, you know. Of course, I understand that I eat meat and everything, but I don't want to kill anything myself, you know. It doesn't have to be my hands to do it.
So you'd rather beat up on chocolate.
So I would work all day in the savory side in the Garmager, but at night they had a pastry chef who was amazing, making chocolate bridges and butterflies and all stuff. And I was like, "Can you teach me? I want to learn." He's like, "Oh, you don't want to learn. You're American, and B, you're just a cook. You know, you don't care, blah blah." So he wrote down like the temperature chart for crystallizing chocolate on the table. He's like, "You learn these numbers, and I'll teach you." And every day I got the numbers wrong, of course. And I just started cheating and just writing it on my arm and stuff. And finally he let me start training me. So finally I would work for free every day after my regular shift for him. And when he had an opening, he switched. And I'd already been accepted at the Culinary Institute of America for culinary, so I called the school and said, okay, I want to switch to pastry.
Oh, that's wonderful. And the rest was written stone, huh?
Yeah, so my first day at CAA was my 18th birthday. I graduated at CAA by 19, and I was in the kitchen at Danielle with François Payard by 19.
And he was impressed.
You worked with François Payard?
Yeah, for Payard at Danielle for 3.5 years, and then I left with him, and I opened Payard with him as sous chef.
Oh, that's a lovely place. We went there for lunch about 2 years ago, and it's really
delicious.
Wonderful.
He's a good interview too.
It's like a little bit of Paris in the middle of New York.
Yeah. Definitely.
Now people say that you do all of the traditional anything you can do, like you're a wizard, all that, but you're really interested in more experimental techniques. So you combine the flavor end of it, your passion for flavors, with a little contemporary technique?
For sure. I mean, I definitely have classic training, and I think that's helped me catapult forward with all the newer stuff as well, because I think it's like building a house. You know, if you don't have a strong foundation, you're not going to be able to keep building high. You know, you can't keep going higher and higher. So for me, I'm very lucky to have a very classic French background in my training, but I'm also American. Like, I don't have the blinders on, maybe, you know, like they do traditionally. So I'm very experimental as far as, like, okay, well, What else can we do? And now, you know, with all these new ingredients, you know, a lot of people are calling them chemicals or molecular. It's not. You know, they're ingredients. They're ingredients that have been around for a long time. Ingredients that are made naturally from seaweeds or, you know, brown seaweeds
agar,
and red seaweeds.
Yeah,
yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, there's lots of stuff that's around that's been around for a long time from different plants and vegetables that, you know, people just don't understand. So they're putting this horrible title called molecular gastronomy on it. It's just stupid. You know, the thing that's giving it a bad name is the fact that people are all trying to just do it without understanding how it works. It's like, you wouldn't use salt without understanding what salt does. You know, you wouldn't use, why would you use any of this other stuff? You know, it's so important to understand your ingredients.
Yeah, I mean, we're subjected to all kinds of junk. You have no idea. Let's talk about the organization of the book. You have four plays, the F-O-U-R plays, for spring, summer, autumn, and winter. Then you switch to chocolate. Is that your favorite ingredient, chocolate?
I think it's people in general. You know, we sell more chocolate tastings and more chocolate desserts than anything else. For sure, we always, even though we go through the season, because I'm very market-driven, and, you know, the markets have to do with what fruits and vegetables. So all the other seasons, we focused on fruits and vegetables, you know.
Right.
So we said, okay, well, there's a lot of chocolate lovers in the world, so we wouldn't want to alienate them. So we said, okay, well, let's do a whole chapter dedicated to chocolate, you know, for those chocoholics. You know,
and
the book actually is a reflection of a year at Jean George. Well, how would a year, if you were to eat every season at Jean George, how would it work out? What kind of desserts would you might have? You know, and this is a, you know, an actual portrayal. These are all desserts that we've been doing at Jean George over the years, you know.
Now, you have a section called Building Blocks. Would you explain that?
The building blocks goes back to the foundation. So much of what we do when we create a dessert is say, okay, well, we have you pick a flavor or an ingredient, say it's strawberry season. You're like, okay, strawberries. And the way I make a dessert is I'll list everything I can think of that's strawberries, you know, like strawberry shortcake, strawberry this, strawberry that, you know, pies, whatever. Then I start writing down textures like, okay, something crunchy, because I always want something, you know, creamy, something crunchy, something salty, something, you know. I always try to hit all the different senses. So
with each one of these quartets, you mean?
Yeah.
I see.
No, in an individual dessert. Each dessert has to have contrast.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The four plays, you know, the individual desserts have to be able to stand on their own, as well as work in conjunction with the other three desserts. So the building blocks are there to say, okay, well, if I want to make a tart, you know, what kind of dough should I use, or what should the sablé be? Should it be nut based? Should it be just flour? Should it be saltier? Should it be flaky? Should it be crumbly? Like, you know, so the building blocks are all about, you know, the basics of like, it's like the guts of the desserts, like the stuff that gives you your makeup, your foundation of your dessert, and then from there it's like, you know, it's just to give people a head start, like a jump.
So, but anybody's supposed to be able to. It's going to stretch you a little bit, but the average home baker could use this book.
Well, you know, the book is definitely for someone who wants to cook. This isn't something for a kid to come home from school and necessarily make cookies.
No.
You know, there's enough of those books in the market. The idea is, for me, I believe a book should be educational. But at the same time, I think it should be, you know, inspiring. And I think it should be, people should be able to approach it. You know, there shouldn't be anything in there that you feel like, oh, I can't do this. You know, the pictures are very beautiful, but it's only
gorgeous.
Because I took that extra minute to think, how do I want to put this on a plate, you know? I could easily have just piled it up and made it look sloppy, but I just took that extra minute to say, how could I creatively put these simple things on a plate? And it's that simple. People don't have to do anything the way I do it. You plate it any way you want to do it. You know, but what we did do for the book is we put in these boxes called the Make It Simpler boxes.
I love that.
And what they do is they're like built-in shortcuts. It's such an amazing concept that, you know, you look at this thing and say, okay, there's too many recipes, there's too many things. Okay, but then all of a sudden there's this little box saying, okay, well, if you don't have a lot of time, you could buy this here, you could take this jam here from the store, or get this shell from the store, or, you know, buy the ice cream. I mean, there's so many different ways to cut corners, you know. And so we've made it so people can actually go home and say, okay, well, I can make two of the components out of four or something, buy the other two, and still have a homemade plated dessert for my guests.
Yeah.
Now, does it make you feel funny sometimes when you create these absolutely glorious-looking plates, and then the first thing that happens is that the diner destroys them? Do you feel like a little piece of you is being lost when that happens?
No,
not at all. Of course not.
You know, I love that people take my stuff apart, because I don't, you know, all the books I have, I don't think I ever made a recipe exactly the way it was ever printed in a book. Sometimes I go home on the weekends, or I'm up I have a house in the mountains, and I cook from like these books, like, and I like, you know, you start off with their idea and then you go your own direction. And I think that's great. You know, the book is meant to inspire people to create something on their own, you know, and like, of course, no, I don't want anybody to do it the way I do it. I want them to do it their way. I just want my book to help them get there.
All right, there's a level of sophistication and flavors in this book that is absolutely extraordinary, like rhubarb.
Yeah.
Who are your good buddies, contemporaries in the pastry Chef Mang?
For sure, my generation is definitely a generation that's changed a lot of things, you know.
That's for sure. Tell me.
You know, especially in New York, like my very good friends are Sam Mason and Taylor,
Sam.
You know, Wiley Dufresne is a friend.
Adore
Dave Chang.
Yeah.
Dave Arnold at the FCI, Neil Lauren. I mean, these guys are all really, really creative guys. Paul Liebrand, George Mendez, like,
oh, yeah.
we're all about the same age, you know, a year, a couple years apart. And the thing is, it's like, we're not competitive with each other. You know, we all try to help each other or share with each other to get to the next level together. You know, whereas maybe the older guard, the older generations of chefs, you know, were kind of more guarded with their secrets and
right.
their recipes and the way they did things. And, you know, that's fine for them. I mean, but that's not the way we are. You know, we're very much about going forward together.
You have an extraordinary peer group now that you started mentioning all these names.
Yeah.
Yeah. Overall, like, the greatest influence in your direction. And your
greatest influence?
Person.
I don't know if I'd be able to pinpoint on one. I mean, for sure, Payard was a huge one. Daniel Boulud is like a father figure to me.
Isn't he fabulous?
George, my style has changed so much. You know, I've become much more worldly. You know, he's exposed me to so many new ingredients and new techniques that I never was exposed to before. And Thomas Haas, who actually taught me finesse of a dessert. You know, he was the pastry chef at Danielle when we reopened. And I spent 18 months working for him as his sous chef. And he's really a technician when it comes to desserts, as far as pinpointing flavor profiles, you know, and really getting the most you can out of a ingredient. So those
where
guys
is
are
he
all,
now?
He's up at he actually opened up his own place called Thomas Haas Chocolates in Vancouver.
Oh.
And he's awesome, man. He's like this crazy German, like high energy. You think I talk fast? He's like me, you know, but except he has an accent. But it's even funnier. So it's like, I learned so much from him. You know, I owe so much of who I am today to him, too.
Well, this is an absolutely glorious book called Dessert Foreplay, F-O-U-R. Johnny Unizi has a website as well.
It's
first name, last name, without anything between them,
.com.
And there are crazy pictures of him on there and all kinds of other adventures I didn't get time to explore entirely.
It's fun to talk to you, too, Johnny.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you guys as well.
Yeah. Okay, well, let us know what's going on next.
Yep. Oh, this weekend I'm going to go down to Charleston. I've never been down there doing this.
Oh, we'll see
you
there.
Are you going down for the festival?
Yep.
We'll see you there.
Oh, great. I'm doing doing a dinner with Wiley, actually. And,
oh, you're with Sean Brock, who's wonderful.
Oh, he's a super guy. Well,
he's very good.
Well, we couldn't get tickets for that, but
they sold out before they even advertised.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I think they're keeping it really small, though, too. It's
they are. They're limiting the number.
Yeah. Saturday I'm doing a demo and a book signing.
Okay, well, we'll see you, because we always run into the book signing people.
Yeah, we wanted to come over to see if we can catch up with Wiley anyway, so maybe
cool.
We'll catch you then. If not, we'll see you around the festival for sure.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to it.
Take a look at the website so you know what we look like.
What's the website?
OnTheMenuRadio.com.
Got it. All right.
Thank you so much for joining us,
Johnny,
and we'll see you
soon. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
I'll see you in
care.
Charleston. Bye. And now it's time to take a sweet break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. If you have any sweet thoughts, please email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com or blog us at onthemenuradio.blogspot.com or come Twitter with me at OTMDish. That's twitter.com. And then I'm on Facebook. I don't know where that's going. I have so many friends.
Well, let's turn our attention back to this.
Okay, we're talking about the sweet theme
of the day.
Yeah, we're not just talking about a master of treats here. Jacques Torres he's like not just a wizard. He's fabulous chocolate artist. If you look at any of the pictures of his chocolate work in his book. But anyhow, we talked to Jacques, and he's telling us all his little tricks and secrets about making chocolate desserts. This is going to be a very sweet show. We have on the phone the classically trained chocolatier, well, pastry chef to start with, Jacques Torres, who is renowned for
his fabulous chocolates, and he's just written a book called A Year in Chocolate. Jacques, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Now, you were French born and trained, and then you came here and you had an extraordinary 11 years as pastry chef at Le Cirque, which you must have a lot of stories about that, right?
Yes, it was a beautiful place.
Yes, indeed. And my big question about this wonderful book we got, because you have two other books as well, is this takes you through the year, the calendar year, and you have chocolates designed for every holiday with recipes. And I wonder, it's such a useful and such it's a perfect book. I wonder why nobody ever did that before.
I don't know. I try to make things simple and think about what is the life of a chocolatier, what is the life of someone who has a business and make chocolate all year, and what makes you do different things. And basically the holidays and the different months and the season and, you know, all those things. So I decided to write A Year in Chocolates. And that was, to me, that was coming under the sense of, you know, my life. And that's what that book reflects.
You have so many good tips also, and you make tempering chocolate understandable. I've never successfully done that.
You know, chocolate or even cooking is a little bit like riding a bicycle. The first time that you do it, you might fail. You might fail a couple of times, but if you keep trying, eventually you will succeed and enjoy it. And I think, you know, a lot of things in cooking, in pastry, in chocolate are the same. You have to keep coming at it.
Right.
Now, this seasonal look, Jacques, this was your idea, but it came from the fact that you were in a pastry kitchen and you had to turn out things that were appropriate to particular seasons. Is that sort of the way it began?
Yes, all my life, all my life as a pastry chef in a restaurant, in a pastry shop, and as a chocolatier now, I had to do things with the season all the time. When Christmas comes, of course, you know, if you're a pastry chef, you're going to make a lot of Christmas logs and holiday desserts. And for a chocolatier, then you're going to start to make all those Santa and all those beautiful Christmas tree and you know, different stuff. So again, you know, that's the type of things that you follow all year as a pastry chef or as a chocolatier.
Now, is Valentine's Day a big day too?
So Valentine's Day is the biggest single day of the year.
Oh, wow. Okay, it's the biggest single one.
It's the biggest one single day. So what I mean is, if you look at the revenue of the three biggest holidays, Christmas, Easter, and Valentine, they will go into that order. Christmas first, because it's long and people buy a lot of gifts. Second will be Easter. It's Easter go for between 10 days and a week. And then you have, finally, Valentine will go for, you know, 4 days, maximum 3-4 days. Mm-hmm. But Valentine is very condensed. But the total sale at the third one.
Now, give us an idea of, then, for our listeners' benefit, because they don't have the book in front of them. What's front and center for Valentine's Day as far as your book is concerned?
You know, I have to look at the book now.
Okay, yeah.
I wrote it a couple of years ago, so I don't remember.
You can't remember, okay.
Well, you have you have intertwined hearts with black and white.
Black and white hearts, I remember that, with a chocolate mousse.
Yeah.
Yes.
And let's see, what else do you have? February, right?
Yeah, you'll have to go to February.
While I'm looking for this, jump back after you finished at the Le Cirque. After 11 years, you opened, in 2000, you opened your first chocolate factory in Brooklyn.
Yes.
And then you opened a second one in 2004 in Manhattan.
Correct.
Could you tell our your website and also the location of your shops?
Okay, so what's going on is when I was at Le Cirque for 12 years, it was time for me to move on, to do something else. You know, after giving as much as you can give to a place like Le Cirque for so long, I decide that I'm going to open my own business and I'm going to make chocolates. So I find a beautiful place in Dumbo, Brooklyn, very historical, a lot of stone, cobblestone, you know, interesting building, but also very run down. In 2000, Dumbo was not the Dumbo of today.
No, this is true. It's really coming
around. So I move in. And with two friends, we build, and we build it ourselves. We don't have a contractor or anyone. We build ourselves the space. So all the sheet rack, you know, straightening the floor and all that stuff, the furniture in the store in Brooklyn, I make them. You know, a lot of sweat equity into that place.
Uh-huh.
And very surprisingly, right away the place was successful. We had customer coming right away. Still today, I don't understand how that happened, but Brooklyn was really supporting us, and a lot of customer was coming. So the company grew, you know, fairly fast. 4 years later, we start to run out of space. We opened a big space in downtown Manhattan, Hudson and King. So that place is 8,000 square foot. The manufacturer is on the middle of the space. So when you are, the store is on the middle of the space. So when you come in, you are inside the manufacturing space. So imagine a big rectangle, and inside the rectangle you have an oval, the shape of a cacao pod, and that's the store. And the rectangle, the leftover rectangle, is the manufacturer, and you can see people walking through the glass. So it's very interactive, very visual place, and you see people running around with now with big rabbit on their hands, and you see the spinner moving the mold up and down, and chocolate flowing, you know, from machine and cutting pen going. I mean, it's amazing. It's beautiful to see.
We're going to have to put that on our calendar for when we're next in New York to come see that.
Please. It's very visual.
Yeah, so, is it a chocolate shop, or is it also like a bakery where you can stay and eat what you bought?
You can definitely sit. We have seats. We have couch.
So you do have seats.
Yeah, we have couches. Also, so you can even lay down if you like. You can sit, you can lay down. We serve hot chocolate, cappuccino, espresso, all kind of drinks. No alcohol, but a lot of drinks. So you can have one of those drinks, sit, have a croissant. We do some very French croissant, and we make cookies who are unbelievable. We have so much success with our cookies, and it's always surprising that a Frenchman get success with such an American icon like the cookies.
I think you've been adopted.
Thank you very much. I think I'm an American too.
I think that's what's happened now.
Yeah. I have these Valentine sweethearts.
Okay,
you have cookie hearts, sandwiching two creamy flavors of mousse.
Yes.
And then you have a decoration, very elaborate chocolate decoration on it. You have a lot of good tips for decorating in this book, but the stuff's still good even if you don't decorate, right?
Of course, you know, decoration is very visual, but it's not always what you need. Let's say that it will be as good without those pieces of chocolate on top.
I did see the wonderful chocolate rabbit, which is in the next is in the next chapter.
Yeah, the chocolate rabbit, and you have some really good tips about molds. I was shocked. I thought that the metal molds, because I have clay molds, I have metal molds, you know, old molds. And you said they're not particularly good, that the best thing is hard plastic.
You know, those molds are gorgeous, and I am also a collectioner, like a lot of people in my profession, of antique mold.
Yeah.
But you will never see those as professional using those antique molds. They get dented.
They do, yes.
Yeah, and they rust a little bit, so the chocolate will stick. And one of the things is, you know, when you touch a piece of metal, it's always cold. So you have to warm up the surface of those molds with a hair dryer to the temperature of the chocolate. Then you have to pour your chocolate inside. You know, it's really an extra step. When you use polycarbonate mold, you know, just wipe them, put the chocolates in it, and you're done.
Is there because the plastic mold stays at room temperature, I guess?
Correct, yes. So that's one of the things. And also,
see, that hair dryer is another one of your tips. So you use a hair dryer for bringing back temper and chocolate, too.
Correct. Instead of putting it in the stove or in the microwave, it's a lot more gentle. But, you know, chocolate will be more shiny as the surface where you mold it is smooth. So a very, very, very polished surface will give you a very shiny chocolate.
Which is, of course, what you're looking for, right?
Yeah.
So if you imagine metal, it's very difficult to polish the metal as much that you will polish a polycarbonate mold.
Now, tell us about the Cheerios. You were telling us off the air. You just absolutely have to tell our listeners about chocolate-covered Cheerios.
Cheerios is, you know, it's part of it's a little bit of the story of our business. We look at what the customer eat and love, and we try to adapt that to chocolates. So about the Cheerios, I was one day walking and having an espresso at the bar, and I saw a lady came with a baby. The baby was crying. You know, he was mad about something. So, and she reached in a purse and take a Ziploc bag and give to that kid a few Cheerios in front of him. And the baby stopped crying right away. Recognize the Cheerios, start to eat that stuff. And again, I don't have any kids. I don't know that product. So I went to that lady and asked her, I said, what is that magic thing that you give him? And she told me, she said, you know, they're Cheerios, you know, cereals. So I take I have a bicycle always here. Take my bicycle, went to the store, buy five big boxes of Cheerios, come back, dump that in a machine, and coat them with milk chocolates. I'm thinking, you know, Cheerios, chocolates, and milk for breakfast. I mean, why not?
Oh, great.
And then put that in a store and just observe what customer going to say about it. And, you know, it takes 30 minutes to empty that big bowl of cereal.
You had to get on your bike again and buy five more pounds.
So I basically order a pallet of it and start making them and bag them and sell them in the store, and it's a big success. You know, we sell a lot of those Cheerios, and just because it's good, that, you know, it's just plain good. I don't judge. I just try to make what people love. But interestingly now, when I see adults crying, I just give them some Cheerios, and I'm telling you, it works. Even adults stop crying with that stuff.
We were laughing that you must be handing out milk. Chocolate-covered Cheerios outside Bernie Madoff's apartment trying to calm people down.
Whoever, I'm not judging. Whoever needs some uplifting Cheerios, you know, we are here.
Yeah. This wonderful book is called A Year in Chocolate.
Yeah. 80 recipes, mind you.
The wonderful part, but the wonderful part about it is, I'll bet if you go to the Mr. Chocolate stores, you'll find that there are 365 different chocolate desserts you can have.
Jacques, you've been absolutely a delight to talk to, and I certainly enjoyed this a great deal. And I hope to explore your store when we're in Manhattan next.
Please stop by, and you guys are wonderful too to talk to, so thank you very much.
have a great day, Jacques.
Thank you. Have a beautiful day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, ciao. Time again to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You know, that was an interesting tip about using the hairdryer that Jacques gave us. You know, hairdryer is sort of an amazing invention. I wonder if we've never gotten a book on that. We've gotten a book about just about everything else. Remember the history of the hairdryer.
Well, if somebody's out there in hairdryer land, you know, be sure to send us one. Now we've got a deliberate mixture in the final segment of the program today, because we've been fascinated for a long time by the wonderful product which comes mostly from Madagascar called vanilla. And we've learned a lot more about the vanilla bean than most people have in their whole lives. And we've found out a whole lot more from Beth Nielsen, who's the several generations member of a family.
Seventh generation.
Yeah, we've called Nielsen Massey, although the Masseys went away after one generation.
Yeah.
And their entire enterprise is devoted to fine extracts.
But you know, we also saw that the paste, I never knew there was a vanilla paste, and of course we know about vanilla sugar, and then there were a couple other odd things that they make out of vanilla.
Well, but Beth sent us a whole whole box of goodies, so mm-hmm. We have vanilla in all forms and shapes and sizes.
Just think, all the things you could not make if you did not have vanilla.
But it's a really fascinating story. There's a whole lot more to this product than vanilla ice cream, as you'll discover.
Economy, culture,
and then in honor of the fact that really Miss N doesn't eat very much dessert, and I guess everybody in the world, or an increasingly large number of people in the world, know that. So Laura Whirlin must have found that out, because she sent us not only a book about the famous American cheese sandwich, but included in it a box with all the
makings of.
All the makings of a great cheese sandwich. And she talked very entertainingly to us about that American institution, the cheese sandwich. And I understand that this is a time for cheese sandwiches. cheese sandwiches are good recession food, I guess.
Well, let's run these two.
So there's some good recommendations.
We're going to run them back to back,
and
then we'll have to
we'll,
do anything more from us.
And then we'll come back and say goodbye.
Beth Nielsen, welcome to On the Menu. It's it's been a while trying to get this organized, this interview. At first, we were approached by your publicist suggesting that a touch of vanilla behind the ears would be very good for Valentine's Day. Is that true?
Yes, it's very true. Vanilla is one of those scents and aromas that I think that people find both sweet and reminds them of home.
Uh-huh.
So
that's its aphrodisiac quality. It reminds you of home.
Yeah.
Okay, now, let's talk about...
Didn't happen. There were a lot of suggestions of Valentine's Day.
So can I ask you, Anne, did you put some behind your ears?
She didn't do that either.
I didn't even have any. That's the other problem.
We were in London and there was none close by.
Well, we saw our product in the UK as well.
We weren't looking for it, so we didn't find it.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Tell us about the company. Nielsen Massey Vanillas it sets the standard in the vanilla industry, does it not?
Yes, we are considered the premium vanilla company, and mostly because of our process that we use.
The cold press.
Yes, we do a cold extraction process which maintains the 250 to 300 different flavor components of one single vanilla bean.
See, that's what I didn't understand at all. I mean, I never knew that existed.
Yeah, and when you add heat, those diminish. So that's why we use a cold process. So
what are all those flavors?
Well, there's only one that has been able to be duplicated, and that is vanillin.
Oh, right.
Okay. Because there's natural vanillin, of course, in vanilla beans. It's natural.
Right.
But they have, and then, of course, there's the artificial vanillin, which is the imitation of the natural vanillin in a vanilla bean. But that's the only one that anyone's been able to somewhat replicate.
Let's jump back a bit. You're third generation of this family run company.
Correct.
And you're celebrating a 100th anniversary, which is why you produced this book called A Century of Flavor. You said you've grown up with vanilla. It's been your whole life. It must be amazing to be born into such an institution as this.
It definitely is. I mean, it's not something that I think my brothers nor I realized until later in life. In fact, when I was young, I used to tell everybody my father worked in a candy factory because he smelled so good when he came home. And when you're young, like you don't understand what a vanilla factory is. So I just told everyone he worked at a candy factory because he always smelled like candy.
Now, your location's not the most exotic. I mean, vanilla seems exotic. Madagascar, where it comes from, seems like an exotic place.
And Tahiti.
And you're in where?
We're outside of Chicago.
Which is very exotic.
Some people might think so.
Okay.
Well, now, I've read that this whole company started out as something having to do with cleaning products?
Yes. Actually, Richard Massey, who started it, and then our grandfather partnered with him about a decade later, they initially had different flavors to add to, or I should say scents and aromas, to add to cleaning products to make them smell better.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Seems like a thoroughly unsuitable thing to do with something as exotic as vanilla.
Yeah, well, it wasn't vanilla at the time.
Oh, I see.
That's
okay.
What I'm saying. The company didn't. They weren't using the vanilla for that. They were doing these other aromas for cleaning products. And when my grandfather partnered on the business, then that's when they started doing vanilla as a food ingredient.
Now, how did they settle on vanilla, do you think?
The early history is not well documented. In fact, pretty much not documented at all.
Oh, dear.
So we really don't know a lot about the history. When we had our 100th anniversary party and celebration 2 years ago, I actually contacted, I spent about a year trying to find relatives of the Massey side.
Uh-huh.
And we actually did have two members of the Massey side. It was actually it was Richard Massey's grandson who ended up coming with his wife. and he knew less than we did. So.
Oh no!
So unfortunately, you know, we don't have too much information on the history.
Well, let's go back to the process. Basically, this vanilla bean is grown. It's an orchid.
Yes, it is the only fruit bearing orchid.
Right, it's green or something, isn't it? The orchid.
Yes. The orchid is kind of white with green flecks. It's, as far as orchids are concerned, it's not aesthetically beautiful. I mean, it's very, very simple. I mean, I find it beautiful, but it's just kind of white with this kind of lime green flecks and detail on it.
Now, it's a rigorous process getting the pollination. Tell us about that.
Well, when all vanilla pretty much originated in Mexico, and when they finally brought it from Mexico over to Madagascar to grow it, they were having problems because it was discovered later that there's a Melipona bee that was pollinating all of the orchids in Mexico. So, of course, they didn't have the Melipona bee over in Madagascar. So the story goes that there was actually one of the slaves, that, you know, this is back, way back, they brought him from Mexico, and he had a way to hand pollinate, mimicking what the Melipona bee was doing.
Uh-huh.
So that is, to this day, how vanilla orchids are pollinated. They're hand-pollinated, and it's like a bamboo kind of straw, I believe. Of course, there are plantations that do it mechanically, but they aren't getting the volume of vanilla beans, but it's kind of one of those throwing mud at a wall type situations. I mean, we use only the plantations that are using the old process of hand-pollination, because the orchid only flowers once for that flower. It's only once, and it's only on one day.
Oh, I thought it said 2 weeks.
No,
not everybody flowered all at the same time.
No, they do not flower all at the same time. I mean, there could be one vine could have, you know, I don't know, 20 possibilities for a flower.
I see. Okay.
But they won't all flower on the same day, and it's only for one day, and that's when it needs to be hand pollinated.
Wow,
so
it's
obviously
complicated.
Very time consuming. You know, they just have to keep every day walking and seeing when there's an orchid blooming, and then they need to hand pollinate it right then, because if they don't do it that day, it's gone the next.
Now, we were talking before we came on the air, and we said, well, to us, vanilla is synonymous with sweet and with candy and with ice cream and things like that. And you said, yes, that's true, but when I cook savory things. So you do savory things with vanilla? There are a few savory recipes in the book. But
yeah,
not nearly as many as there are sweet ones.
Right. There's several savory recipes in there. But one of the things in there, like there's the eggplant dish, and there's...
Yeah, that's hard to envision. I mean, I'd like to actually try that.
Well, one of my little kind of secrets that I tell everybody, so it's not a secret, but is for things that I use tomatoes, so like a pasta sauce or a salsa or chili.
Yeah, I saw that. You put in some vanilla.
You put vanilla in, because you know how people put sugar in those things to cut the acidity of the tomatoes?
Mm, which I hate, yeah.
Yeah. Well, instead of adding sugar, you just add a little bit of vanilla, and it cuts that acidity, and then it smooths out all of the other flavors and almost, kind of enhances them as well. So your basil is going to be more enhanced, and it melds everything together. So I never use sugar for things like that, but I always add vanilla, and it makes
this
a huge
is
difference.
Great. Of course, you have access to a lot of vanilla, I guess.
Yes.
I mean, here's fresh basil, tomato soup with vanilla, and crab cakes with vanilla,
mm-hmm.
golden squash biscuits. It all sounds just yummy.
Next time I make chili will be my secret ingredient.
Yes, definitely. With chili, I would recommend using our Mexican vanilla.
Okay, that's
kind of got that spicy note.
Well, I only have one kind so far, so if I don't get any more, I'll have to use the one I have.
Madagascar is great because it's universal. But
I do use Rick Bayless's recipe, and I noticed he had a couple of recipes in your book.
Yes, he had the Flan Classico.
Okay. Yes.
Well, I use his recipe for chili, so we'll try it next time I make some. I'm enthused to make some chili again. I haven't made any for a long time.
Well, I mean, as I understand it, from all these testimonials in this book, in your book, there's some of the most accomplished bakers and chefs that would use nothing but your product.
Yes, that's That's what they tell us, and yeah, definitely.
And I think it's great that, any company that's still family-run and still making money in this this economy, I think that's great, too. And you have an expanded product line. Do you want to just give us maybe your website and people can check it out?
Sure. Our website is www.nielsenmassey.com, and Nielsen Massey is NIELSENMASSEY, all one word.
Okay, no hyphen.
No hyphens.
Okay. And you're continuing to work, you have different extracts, not just vanilla. You're continuing to expand your line.
Yes, a few years back, we actually decided to revisit some of the early years in kind of, again, celebration of the anniversary. But to most of the chefs that we work with, they were all, and our customers were asking us to develop non-vanilla pure flavors because they knew if we did it that it would be excellent. So we now have 8 non-vanilla pure flavors. We have lemon and orange, almond, chocolate, coffee, peppermint, orange blossom, rose.
Yes. I wanted to ask you this. You were well on your way to a stage career and you decided to join the family business?
No. No, I acted all through high school, and that was it.
I see. And most people act out in high school. You just acted. That's good. Well, Beth, thank you for talking to us, and I hope people will explore your product line and get a hold of this book because the photographs are gorgeous and the recipes are really inspiring. I mean, I was sitting here thinking, I'm going to have to make some of this thing, particularly eggplant parmesan.
Yes, and I will send you guys a care package with everything.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Okay.
That's great. Beth, and say hello to your brothers.
I sure will.
And keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Laura Werlin, I really wanted to ask you before we get into our discussion of grilled cheese month, or whatever it's called here. This is April's Grilled Cheese, National Grilled Cheese Month. I forgot to ask you before this. How long have you been a cheese expert?
Well, I have been enjoying cheese since the time I could get it in my mouth and actually swallow it, which may have preceded my having teeth, I'm not sure. But I have been writing books about cheese for 10 years.
So, I mean, hasn't everything just totally changed since you approached the subject?
Well, no question
about it. With American cheese particularly.
Yes. Well, that is my interest and passion is American cheese. And when I set out to write my first book, which is called The New American Cheese, back in 2000, I thought, I want to write about American cheese and are they, you know, how good are they going to be, these cheeses, because I knew that there were some good ones around the country. But then I started eating these cheeses in Wisconsin and other parts of the country, and I was just blown away by the quality of cheese that was being made here. But most people didn't think that there was great American cheese being
made. Oh, yeah, but isn't there now, huh?
Well, it's just the evolution and the revolution has been amazing.
Yes. Well, anyhow, back to the subject at hand. We received the makings of the cheese, a grilled cheese sandwich from one of your wonderful creative recipes, and this nice book called Great Grilled Cheese that you wrote, which is 50 innovative recipes for stovetop grill and sandwich maker grilled cheese sandwiches, and they are so creative, I was blown away. Who would have thought ever that you could do this much with a grilled cheese sandwich?
Well, what I discovered early on is that a grilled cheese sandwich, the contents of it, are limited only by your imagination. So it's basically the sky is the limit. So a walk down the produce aisle served as inspiration for a grilled cheese sandwich for me, and certainly all of the wonderful cheeses that are available now are, you know, were the main inspiration.
Now you were able to vary the recipes by varying the cheese included, but also the bread,
mm-hmm.
additional fillings, seasonings.
Well, yes. I mean, because, for instance, if I came upon a new cheese, which I did recently, actually, it's this spectacular Gouda made by a small farm up in Wisconsin, and that was the inspiration for my Dutch grilled cheese sandwich, which is
what you sent, yeah.
Right. So it's Gouda and caramelized onions on, you know, on bread.
Red onions.
Red onions, preferably, yeah. But it doesn't have to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you get this melting cheese, and you get these melting onions, and you've got the caraway seeds that are in the bread, which is traditional in Holland for a particular kind of Gouda. So, you know, it's simple to make a really great
and cumin
sandwich. And cumin as well, which is another traditional Dutch Gouda.
Is it? I didn't know that.
Now, one of the interesting things about the book is that for each recipe you give instructions for the different devices that people might have for making a grilled cheese sandwich. Go over those very quickly.
Yeah, well, as the title suggests, stovetop, sandwich maker, and grill. You can make a great grilled cheese sandwich in any one of those methods. So the stovetop, I like to use a nonstick pan, and then with the panini maker or sandwich maker, those usually are nonstick, and then a lot of times you're outdoors, so why not make a grilled cheese sandwich out there? It works just as well. And the methods are pretty similar among the three devices, if you will, but it's just a matter, again, of using your imagination and realizing that you can make a good grilled cheese sandwich anywhere.
Now, this is perfectly on trend for as a comfort food, since we're all looking for as much comfort as we can get. And I pointed out to you that actually I existed almost entirely on grilled cheese sandwiches when I was in college, and you said that was not unusual, and a lot of people have bought your book to send off with their children starting out in college, huh?
Well, yes. I mean, because it's simple and it's satisfying, and in these economic times, simple and satisfying and inexpensive are really, you know, the most important things, I think, that people are looking for. And, you know, one bite of an oozy, melting grilled cheese sandwich, you know, is just enough to make you feel like you're indulging in a bit of decadence, even though it might have cost you pennies to make. I mean, I have one sandwich in the book that I call a cheesy gas house egg.
I saw that one. That's pretty clever. Now, did you and your friend actually make up that name, or did you copy
no.
it from somebody?
No, it was the name that I grew up with. A gas house egg was one where you put a little hole in the bread and then broke the egg, and that went into that hole in the pan, and where there was butter already sizzling. And then you cook the egg that way, and sometimes you turn it unless you wanted it sunny side up. So I thought, well, why not take that concept, because I loved it as a little kid, and somehow add cheese. So with that came the cheesy gas house egg, and I've used all kinds of cheeses, but there's a Gruyere that I love that's made up in Wisconsin that just melts beautifully, and also Monterey Jack from there, and or you can use cheddar. You can use just about any cheese that melts well, and then you've got this egg and the bread, and it's just really, it's the ultimate in comfort food, and it just costs pennies to make.
Is that toad in the hole the same thing?
No, toad in the hole is a piece of sausage.
Oh, okay.
In the most horrible, gooey sort of Yorkshire pudding type mixture you've ever seen in your whole life.
Although I do think that sometimes it is, in this country, toad in the hole is referred to as this gas house egg.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe it is, but I can tell you that real toad in the hole is made with sausage.
That's right. Yeah, no, you're exactly right.
Now, we should point out
mustn't go messing around with these famous English contributions to the world of the culinary arts.
Well, I wanted to point out that you're actually working with the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board on this Grilled Cheese Month promotion. And I have to ask you, do you think that that's where the best of these cheeses are? I mean, as opposed to like Vermont. And we're not talking about the little artisanal so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, what's important to a good grilled cheese sandwich is that you have not only a good melting cheese, but you have a flavorful melting cheese as well. There are a lot of cheeses on the market that'll melt okay, but they don't have a lot of flavor. Somehow, the state of Wisconsin has figured out, or at least the cheesemakers that live there, have figured out how to combine flavor and really great melting cheeses. So, you know, Colby itself was invented in Wisconsin. As I just said a moment ago, Gruyere, I don't know any other state that's making a Gruyere the likes, the kind of which that they make in Wisconsin, which is based on a Swiss recipe. They make Fontina and Havarti, all these cheeses that basically, you know, often supermarket cheeses, not originally, but the ones that we have in this country. And but somehow they have managed to infuse flavor too, and that's, I think, what distinguishes the cheeses that are coming out of Wisconsin. And then they also make a lot of good Italian-style cheeses in Wisconsin. And so I know that earlier we were talking about dessert grilled cheese sandwiches.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to tell us about that.
Well, there are, you can kind of do anything, but one of the ones that has been created is using Wisconsin mascarpone and dulce de leche, which is,
oh, yeah,
you know, kind of like a caramel sauce of sorts. And together on a raisin bread, I mean, you know, how good is that, right? or you can use ricotta, as I do in some of my recipes in the book, which is also a great it dovetails nicely with sweet ingredients. And, you know, like chocolate, for instance, or jam or fruit or, you know, you name it. I have one, I think maybe you saw, I don't know, it's ricotta and marmalade and chocolate sauce, which doesn't sound
right.
Like much of, it doesn't sound like a grilled cheese sandwich, but once it all comes together.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
This is we have a great suggestion for all of our listeners who are trying to figure out what to give to their offspring who are going to be going to college in the fall. This is absolutely the perfect gift. You can buy it on the OTM bookshelf or, for that matter, wherever else you buy your books.
But I bet Laura has OTM a website, don't you?
OTM Bookshelf is a great place to do that. And the neat part about it is it's about the same size and shape as a giant grilled cheese sandwich, and it's the same color. So it's just absolutely the perfect thing for those of you who are struggling to figure out what gift to give.
Laura, don't you have a website?
Yes, I do. It's www.laurawerlin.com. And I just have to say that if some of these recipes from my book already exist on not my website, but on the www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Okay.
So there are my recipes and there are several others as well as tips, because which we didn't talk about, but there are methods for making grilled cheese that are better than others, and I have strong beliefs on that subject. So those are all on that site as well.
Well, get the book, listeners, and pig out on grilled cheese, which I tend to do.
Sure.
Okay, thanks a lot for talking to us, Laura. It's good talking to you again.
Yeah, you too. Nice to hear from you.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, that's all, listeners, for another week. We hope you can stand it without another program between now and next Sunday, and we'll be here with you again, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.